This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Many scientists think we are in the midst of the planet's sixth mass extinction event, and it's our fault. While most attention is focused on keeping the species we still have alive, the idea of bringing back extinct species has been gaining traction in recent years. It's called de-extinction. Now, scientists are definitely getting better and better at both decoding and manipulating genetic material. So the question is, could we once again have herds of woolly mammoths grazing the tundra of the north? More importantly, should we? Beth Shapiro is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at UC Santa Cruz. She's been a Rhodes Scholar, a MacArthur Fellow, and a National Geographic Emerging Explorer. And she is author of the book, How to Clone a Mammoth. Beth, welcome to Living Lab.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you've written this book, How to Clone a Mammoth, but you're not actually advocating for doing it. Why not? What's your objection?
Oh, I don't really know where to begin with objections with cloning mammoths. You know, I don't really object to this technology overall. I do think that there is a place and time for using this genome engineering technology, is what I assume we will be talking about in this hour, using this technology as a method to preserve species that are alive today, to help them, give them a genetic booster shot, if you will, and we'll get there. But how, as far as bringing back something that is already gone, there are quite a lot of technical challenges associated with this. There are ethical considerations, and these are different depending on which species you're talking about. And then there are also ecological considerations. And all three of these challenges, technical, ethical, and ecological, vary depending on which species you're talking about. For me, and mammoths, to address your question directly, I think I draw the line at the ethics of mammoth de-extinction, because it has to involve using Asian elephants. Asian elephants are the closest living relative of a mammoth, and we would need to have a living relative to act as a surrogate mom if we were able to get to that step. And we don't really know how to keep Asian elephants in captivity and have them healthy and happy. And until we have figured out how to do that, I don't think we should be using Asian elephants for mammoth resurrection. Now, there are lots of other problems, as in, you know, will we actually be able to do it? Would we ever really end up with something that is a mammoth, truly a mammoth? And those are technical hurdles. But for me, with mammoth de-extinction, the biggest challenge here is ethical.
So then if you don't think it's actually something we should do, and you actually think that there are a lot of technological hurdles to being able to do it, why write a book about it?
That's a good question. So my research, my lab at Santa Cruz, we study ancient DNA. So we go to the Arctic and other cold places because DNA survives really well in the cold. And we dig up bones and we take a little chunk of those bones back to the lab and we can extract DNA. And what we're interested to learn is how species and populations and ecosystems responded to periods in the past when the planet experienced rapid warming or rapid cooling events, rapid climate change events that happened in the past. And we can hopefully learn from the past to be able to make more informed predictions about how to mitigate the potentially devastating consequences of present day and projected climate change.
So then how do you get from that to the idea of cloning a mammoth?
Mostly out of conversations with people who aren't in my lab. So we would, I've been working in this field for almost 2 decades now. It's hard to imagine, but it's true. And we have found out some really cool things. So we've seen how populations of bison and horses and mammoths were growing and then shrinking. And we can start to figure out why these populations started to collapse, the megafaunal mass extinction that happened around 10 to 15,000 years ago, asking why some species went extinct and other species survive. And we've learned a lot of really cool stuff looking at the DNA. And then we publish these papers and we get calls from people in the media who want us to explain the results we have. And I'm always super excited to talk to people about what our science has taught us that we can use to help species in the present day. But they pretty much only ever want me to answer one question, which is, oh, so does this mean we can clone a mammoth? And so I decided that since there really isn't a soundbite sized answer to that question, I should just write this whole book about all of the different challenges that would be associated with bringing any species back to life. And I use a mammoth because it's the most commonly cited example when people think about de-extinction. As soon as people figure out that we can't bring dinosaurs back, the next best
right,
thing
there's no
seems
Jurassic
to be,
Park. Park happening, thank goodness.
But the next best thing seems to be a mammoth. And so what I did with this book, I've tried to, it is a how-to manual. It is a step-by-step guide to bringing any species back to life. And I focus on a mammoth because, like I say, there are different technical challenges and ethical and ecological challenges for any species you might want to bring back. But the mammoth seems to be such an exciting thing. Everybody knows what a mammoth is. People like mammoths. So let's talk about this. But really as a means to learn about the potential of this technology as a tool for conservation.
In case you're just joining us, my guest is Beth Shapiro of UC Santa Cruz. She's author of the book, How to Clone a Mammoth. Okay, so you've registered at least some of your objections, and we will talk about why you actually do study ancient DNA from mammoths. But I want to actually go through this how-to manual that you have written for how we would, if we wanted to, go about bringing back an extinct species. And you say there are basically seven steps. So can you kind of walk us through what it is that we would have to do to bring back an extinct species?
So one of the first things that I think I highlight in the beginning of the book that we would first have to decide which species we want to bring back. And this gets into ethical and ecological challenges. So once a species has been gone for some time, there might actually not be a place to put them. And this gets back to your very first question when you first started the interview, which was, should we do this? And I think if before we embark on this long road, and I divide it into two phases, phase one is having an animal born, and then phase two would be releasing a healthy population into the wild to have them be able to live and survive on their own. To my mind, that should be the ultimate goal, is not to create a single individual that's going to live in a zoo somewhere where you can go and stare at it, but to have a functional, viable population that you've restored onto into an ecosystem somewhere where by virtue of them being there, they can replace some connection that's been missing in that ecosystem. You know, ecosystems function as giant consortia of species that are working together. There's not just single things out there. If you imagine that a species goes extinct, it had a lot of connections with other species in that ecosystem, and all those connections are suddenly gone. And that will lead to destabilization of that ecosystem for some time. Now, ecosystems are dynamic. They're not going to exist in that state for very long. And it's going to change. The species composition of the ecosystem will change. Maybe the other species will go extinct in a cascading effect after that first extinction. But after some time, there might not be any place to put a resurrected species back into that ecosystem.
Well, so, I mean, you're talking about a place for it in kind of an ecological term, but habitat loss is one of the greatest threats facing many species. And so there may not physically be a space to put these species back into.
Right. So if you think about the passenger pigeon, for example, this is another one of the species that's commonly cited as a potential de-extinction candidate. Passenger pigeons flocked in the billions of individuals along the eastern seaboard. And they lived during a time where there were massive forest stands along the eastern seaboard, and there just aren't anymore. So is there a place today for a billion passenger pigeons? I'm not sure. It's clear that they had tremendous influence on their ecosystem. They would flock in forest stands, and they would all nest at the same time. There would be up to 500 nests in a single tree, and they would just kill enormous swathes of forest by being there and defecating all over everything and killing everything. It's clear that they had a tremendous influence, and it's not clear how the strength of their influence would fare in society today. So this is a candidate where, as you say, habitat loss, habitat change might mean that there really isn't a place for them in modern society. Not so with a mammoth. We can turn to a mammoth and say maybe there's these huge stretches of land, for example, in northeastern Siberia, where a colleague of mine, Sergei Zimov, already has been buying up some land. He's calling it Pleistocene Park. Pleistocene was the time period when
mammoths... Not Jurassic Pleistocene.
That's right. But the same idea, right? right? The geological period when mammoths and other large mega herbivores, they call them, were roaming the world. So he's buying up land called Pleistocene Park and preparing it for de-extinct mammoths. But at the moment, he has things like bison and horses and several different species of deer that are wandering around there. And the idea would be that maybe there is a place for mammoths to go. There aren't too many people up there. They might not be too annoying to people if they were resurrected and put back up there. And maybe they also have some ecological role that they could play up there.
I mean, it sounds like there's at least one person, maybe a small community of people who have made that first decision that you were talking about, that they would like to bring mammoths back and that they think they have a place to put them. And in fact, work has begun to sequence the genome of a mammoth. So how far is it in technical terms from where we are now to actually being able to clone and have an elephant, I guess, give birth to a mammoth?
Well, they're asking technical questions about mammoths now, so we can step into that. First of all, cloning is often what people think about when they think about bringing an extinct species back to life. But cloning is a very specific scientific technology that's called somatic cell nuclear transfer. So our bodies basically have two types of cells. There are germ cells, which are sperm and eggs, and somatic cells, which are everything else, hair cells, skin cells, heart cells, liver cells. They're all somatic cells. What happens normally is the germ cells come together, they fuse, say, form a zygote. That zygote is a special type of cell, stem cells, embryonic stem cells, that have the capacity to become every type of cell that you need to make up a whole organism. They don't have the instructions yet to be very specific types of cells. And as that embryo starts to develop, the cells differentiate. They become more specific. You don't need the same genes expressing in the same amounts to be a liver cell versus a skin cell versus a kidney cell. And so these cells, these somatic cells, as they differentiate, they start to get these specific sets of instructions about how to do the job that they need to do to be that type of cell.
They all have the same DNA. Every cell in our body has the same genetic instructions, but they're using them differently, right?
It's different genes are turned on and turned off in different types of cells because you don't need the same proteins to be different types of cells, but you always have the same bit of DNA. So what happens in somatic cell nuclear transfer, or cloning, and this was the process that most famously brought us Dolly the sheep in the mid-90s, you take one of those somatic cells, a cell that already has a very specific set of instructions about what to do, and you have to trick it into forgetting all of those instructions and reverting back into one of those embryonic stem cells that has the capacity to then divide and differentiate and become an entire organism. And that process is actually pretty hard. It was hard in the mid-90s, and it's still hard today, making that somatic cell forget how to be that type of cell and become an embryonic stem cell. But that's what cloning is. So you take an egg cell that hasn't been fertilized yet, and you suck the nucleus, the genetic material, out of that egg cell, and then you put it next to a somatic cell that's been growing in a dish in a lab and kind of starved of nutrients, really stressed out, and you zap them with a bit of electricity so that the genetic material from that stressed out, starved somatic cell dumps into that egg cell whose own genetic material has been removed, and then the proteins in that egg cell can do that little bit of magic, make that starved, stressed out somatic cell forget all those instructions and revert back into that primordial state where it can then start to develop. But instead of having DNA from mom and dad, from the egg cell and from a sperm, it'll have the exact same copy of DNA from whoever donated that somatic cell, that starved bit of material that you were dumping in there. And that's how we got Dolly the sheep. So if you were going to clone a mammoth, you would have to find a mammoth body, a mummy, and we find mummies all the time, and find a cell that is still alive. And this is a problem. We'll come back to this needing a still alive mammoth cell problem. This is a very big problem.
You can't do it with an elephant cell. You would actually need a live mammoth cell.
Well, if you did it with an elephant cell, you would just end up with an elephant, right? So if you're going to clone a mammoth, you need a mammoth cell, but you need an elephant egg cell because there probably aren't any mammoth egg cells there, right? So you have to take a living mammoth cell and starve the cell in a dish and get an elephant egg cell, suck the egg material out of that elephant egg cell, put these things together, and then make the elephant egg revert that mammoth cell back into the early origins of stuff. So this isn't going to happen because there are no living cells of mammoths that we're ever going to find anywhere. So this is the first stumbling block of cloning a mammoth. And this is the reason why we will never get something that's 100% identical to a mammoth that used to be alive. It's okay. It's not the end of the world.
So this is not the end of the story, because that sounds like that's pretty much it. We don't have a living cell. We can't do this. You know, why are we talking about it?
Well, there. So I like to call that plan A. Plan A, clone a mammoth. Not going to happen because there are never going to be any living mammoth cells. Plan B, the way I describe it in the book, is to sequence the mammoth genome. So we don't have any living mammoth cells, but we have lots of mammoth bones and mammoth mummies, and there's mammoth hair, and there's all mammoth teeth. There's all sorts of cool mammoth stuff that is really well preserved in the frozen tundra of the Asian and North American far north. And we can grind up those bits of pieces of mammoth and extract DNA, and we get these short little broken fragments of DNA out of these frozen bones. So if I were to take a swab of your cheek and extract DNA from that, I could get really long, millions of letters long pieces of DNA, because you're alive, your cells are alive, you're in great condition. But if I were to do this with a mammoth, I get little tiny fragments that are often no longer than about 40 letters long. So if you think about, so the size of a mammoth genome is about 4 billion bases, and I have fragments of DNA that are 40 bases long. It's like having a trillion piece puzzle. Luckily, we have powerful and fast and strong computers, and we can take each of those little tiny broken pieces of mammoth DNA, and we have the elephant genome. So some people have already sequenced and published an elephant genome sequence, and we take each of these tiny little broken puzzle pieces, and we try to figure out where the closest match on the elephant genome is. And in that way, we can start to piece together, a tiny little bit at a time, the mammoth genome sequence using computers. Obviously, we're not doing this, you know, in a lab with pieces of DNA. It's all on computers, but this has been done. And there are now maybe 5 or 6 different mammoth genome sequences that have been assembled on a computer. And we can line those up next to each other and figure out where they're the same as each other and where they're different from the Asian elephant genome. And this is great. So we know that mammoths and Asian elephants are pretty closely related to each other. We now know that, in fact, their genomes are almost 99% identical to each other. It's very similar to us and chimpanzees, right? About the same amount of difference, which means that the number of single letter differences in the DNA code of mammoths versus Asian elephants is about 1.5 million letters. So that gets us to our next step, which is, if we have an elephant cell that we can grow in a dish in a lab, and we know exactly all the places in that genome where elephants are different from mammoths, we can use this genome engineering technology that has been in the news a lot lately, mostly using CRISPR-Cas9 or other genome editing approaches. And we can go into that elephant cell and gradually cut and paste our way from an elephant DNA sequence to something that's a lot more mammoth-like. Now, right now, it is not possible to make 1.5 million changes. Right. But that's technology. The technology will change. It will get better. And maybe at some point it will be possible to make those 1.5 million changes necessary to turn that elephant cell growing in a dish in a lab into something that is much more mammoth-like. Still growing in a dish in a lab, but we're a lot closer at that point to having a living mammoth cell that we can then use in somatic cell nuclear transfer, or this cloning approach.
That's Beth Shapiro. She's a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at UC Santa Cruz and author of How to Clone a Mammoth. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll talk more when Living Lab continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Beth Shapiro of UC Santa Cruz. She's a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology who spends a lot of her time working with ancient DNA from extinct animals like mammoths, whose remains have been frozen in Arctic permafrost. She's written a book, How to Clone a Mammoth, that largely debunks the idea that recreating extinct animals is something we could or should do. So you've laid out this incredibly complex set of puzzles and obstacles and hoops to jump through that might at some point, would you say probably at some point, will become possible to actually create not exactly a clone of a mammoth, but something pretty close?
Well, we're just getting to the process of getting this cell growing in a dish in a lab, and we haven't really gotten to the next technical hurdles that would be involved. But that you know, I think that, yes, the technology is getting better. And in fact, George Church's lab at Harvard has been able to swap out 14 different genes, elephant genes, as swap in the mammoth version of those genes in cells that are growing in a dish in a lab. 14 is not 1.5 million differences, but they've targeted parts of the genome that they believe to be useful for making an elephant, which is a tropically adapted organism, better able to survive somewhere cold. So things involved with being able to move oxygen around the body at lower temperatures, or having longer, more luxurious hair, as George likes to say, or having thicker layers of subcutaneous fat, all some of the phenotypic characteristics that would make an elephant better able to survive in the cold Arctic habitat. So, you know, they are getting a little bit closer. With mammoths and elephants in particular, and again, the different hurdles and technical challenges that would be faced are going to differ depending on what species you're thinking of bringing back. But with elephants, there are technical hurdles that would be involved in the cloning process. So I don't believe that it has been possible yet to perform IVF for elephants in captivity. So this would be something that would have to be done. You would have to have a female elephant that would act as a surrogate host for this animal that was born. If you could then take the cell that you'd edited and transform it into an embryonic stem cell so that it could develop, it could become every type of cell in a body. All these are very hard things. That reprogramming process is very difficult in cloning. It's difficult for living species that we know a lot about their reproductive behavior, and it's going to be very difficult for something that we don't know anything about reproductive behavior because they're extinct.
And have been for a good long time.
Yes, and with mammoths have been extinct for 3,000 years. Was the last population was alive on Wrangel Island. Pretty recently, actually.
That's actually much more recently than I was expecting you to say. So.
Yeah, there were two very late surviving populations of mammoths, one on Wrangel Island, that was the last surviving population, and the penultimate population to go extinct was a population that lived in Alaska, on an island off of Alaska called St. Paul Island. It's part of the Pribilof Islands, and they went extinct there about 5,600 years ago. Lived isolated on that little island for probably 2,000 years after being cut off from the Alaskan mainland. And they eventually went extinct, not because we hunted them to death, and we know that because there were no people on the island until about 100 years ago. But those mammoths went extinct because they lost their last source of fresh water. They actually went extinct because they ran out of water to drink.
How sad.
But fascinating that we can find that out. That's the kind of cool thing that you can find out by looking at ancient DNA and also doing these paleo-environmental reconstructions. But back to cloning them.
Okay, so back to mammoths and maybe bringing them back for the Pribilof Islands. Okay, so assuming we can engineer the genome of an elephant cell to make it basically a mammoth
right.
genome, or in important ways a mammoth genome, figure out how to make that cell more embryonic.
Right.
Figure
and then
out how
to implant that in a surrogate mom.
Right, how to get IVF to work in an elephant.
Right, and then figure out how to get that to go to term. One thing that we don't know very much about is what the effect of having a surrogate host mom would be. So we are, as we know from looking at people who are identical twins, who are basically clones of each other, right? They are genetic clones. We are much more than the sum of the A's, G's, and T's that make up our genetic code. We are a combination of our DNA and the environment in which we live. And that environment begins before birth. So we know that mom's diet and mom's stress and any sort of medication that mom takes, any medical trauma that mom has during birth will affect the way our genes as a developing embryo are going to express. And once we're born, the food we eat, the stresses we have, the diseases that we suffer through, the environment we live in, and even the community of microbes that are established in our gut will change the way our genes are expressed and the way that we look, the way that we act. If you look at identical twins, they're genetically and pretty much behaviorally identical the minute that they're born, but then they become different. And the older they get, the longer in life they have to experience different things, the more different they actually look to each other. They're definitely different people. They have different ideas and different behavior. The same would be true for any type of clone that we were to make, right? It's identical twins are clones that are born at the same time. These would just be identical twins that were born many thousands of years apart in time. But that means that mom's hormones, mom is an elephant, mom's diet, mom is eating elephant food, mom's stresses, mom is an elephant living in a captive environment, and we know that mom doesn't do well in a captive environment if mom is an elephant. All of those things are going to affect the way those genes in that developing mammoth, let's say we've gone that far, are expressing. So we don't know how that's going to affect the mammoth-likeness of this embryo that's developing inside an elephant. And then it's born. The first thing that elephants do when they're born is mom feeds a little bit of baby some of her poop. And that's because they need to establish this community of microorganisms that actually break down the food that they eat. And we know that that community of microorganisms affects the way our genes act. So baby mammoth will now have an elephant gut microbial community.
And a tropical gut community, not an Arctic gut community. I mean, potentially you could, you know, zookeepers could intervene, but would we even know what to feed the baby mammoth to give it the right microbes in its gut to deal with the Arctic?
Yeah, it's a good question, right? And then it will be raised in a social group of elephants, not mammoths. And it will be taught how to live as an elephant, not as a mammoth. And it will live in a captive breeding environment. And elephants are very social animals. And there's no reason to suspect that mammoths wouldn't also have been. And again, this gets back to the ethics of de-extinction of mammoths in particular, that we can set aside for a moment since we're just talking about the technical hurdles here. So creating that DNA code that is mammoth-like from an elephant is one technical hurdle, but then transforming that into a living, breathing mammoth is another series of technical hurdles that we don't really know how to get over. So there's a lot of challenges there if we want to bring something back that is 100% identical to a mammoth that used to be alive. But
why, if there are this many hurdles and so many ethical quandaries involved, why does this idea of de-extinction remain so popular and so fascinating, do you think?
Well, it's fascinating because it's fascinating. Because it genuinely is. And I like to say, while I don't believe that we will ever be able to bring something back that is 100% identical to a species that used to be there, I am actually a fan of the idea of using this approach for the conservation preservation of existing habitats. In the case of a mammoth, if we can set aside for a moment all the ethical challenges and just pretend that they don't exist, and they do, so I'm just pretending they don't exist for a moment to say this, I think that there are plenty of reasons to think about bringing back a mega herbivore to put back into this environment, to help to establish, to reestablish these interactions between the grasslands and the herbivores that used to be there before these animals disappeared. And what's important, what's really important to keep in mind here is that we don't need 100% mammoth to do that. All we need is something that is capable of living where a mammoth once lived and filling the ecological niche that that mammoth once filled.
Something like what you were saying, George Church was creating an Arctic adapted elephant.
Exactly. And if we could do that, and we could reestablish these large herbivores on the landscape, and in doing so, we could cause these grasslands that used to dominate these Siberian tundra to come back. And some of Sergei's work has actually shown that this really does happen. He has, for the last nearly a decade now, had these, he has bison imported from Canada and wild horses and many different species of deer. He has them in these enclosure experiments in his Pleistocene Park in northeastern Siberia. And he's been able to show that where these animals are, it doesn't take more than a couple of years for them wandering around and distributing nutrients and moving seeds and chewing on these grasses to just cause this grassland, this rich, amazing resource that used to be there, to come back all on its own just by being there. And this is amazing. They disappeared, and so did these rich grasslands that supported everything else. You put them back and they actually recreate their own habitat. And he's seen that not only are these animals that he has on his park doing fine by themselves with no additional help necessary, but other things like saiga antelope that are going extinct, they're endangered in this area because there's not enough habitat for them, there's not enough food for them to eat, are coming to visit this park because all of a sudden the grass lands are back. And this is to me the most compelling argument for the idea of de-extinction or genetic rescue or whatever you want to call it, the use of this technology to create organisms that by virtue of them being placed back in a habitat reestablish missing interactions that are gone and enable animals that are alive today to flourish. That this could be a potentially incredible new weapon in what should be a growing arsenal to fight extinction, present day extinction. Not bringing back something that has been gone for a long time, but let's use this technology as an incredibly exciting potential new way to save species that are in danger of going extinct today.
What you're talking about, though, at its core is not preserving or reestablishing what was created by nature, but it is creating whole new species, essentially, and massively, potentially, genetically engineering, saying, well, you know, we'd really like this animal to be able to survive, and if we did this, 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 and this, they'd be able to live in this very altered world that we've created. Is there not a whole set of ethical questions and potentially concerns involved with that as well? I mean, as a society, we're very uncomfortable with the idea of genetically modified organisms to eat or as crops. And you're talking about potentially doing this on a much broader scale.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to get used to the idea of genetically modified organisms. If we're going to feed all the people on this planet, we're going to have to genetically modify things to live in this crazy world that we've created. I think that absolutely there are risks involved with tinkering with genomes. And these risks are things that our species has dealt with at least for the last 30,000 years, which is the first evidence of domestic dogs in the archaeological record. We're simply, with this technology, able to better target the changes that we make and do it faster and potentially in a safer way. We're modifying organisms to be able to keep up with the changes that we've made to this world. And there are definitely risks inherent in doing that, but there are also risks in not doing what we can to try to create organisms or help organisms that are still alive to be able to survive in the environment we're in today. And that is that everything goes extinct because we are changing the world and the planet so quickly and so rapidly that evolution, as in its slow ways of getting it right sometimes and getting it wrong some other times, is just not fast enough to keep up with.
That's Beth Shapiro. She's professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at UC Santa Cruz and author of the book How to Clone a Mammoth. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll talk more when Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest this hour is Beth Shapiro, professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at UC Santa Cruz. Her specialty is working with ancient DNA from extinct animals like mammoths. She's author of the book How to Clone a Mammoth. I want to bring up an idea that you have publicly said you don't think, you don't think we should clone mammoths, so this is even one step further. But we do have a fairly complete genome for Neanderthals. Is there the possibility, given how closely related modern humans and Neanderthals are, that we could potentially clone or do some very close version of cloning a Neanderthal?
Technically, yes. I mean, we have very good technology to be able to edit cells. We know very much how to do IVF in humans. We haven't cloned any humans because there are major ethical considerations there. But technically, would it be possible to take what we know about the Neanderthal genome sequence and take a human cell and swap out bits of the genome for the Neanderthal version of those genes? Yes, it's technically possible. In fact, we know by looking at the distribution of Neanderthal genes, Neanderthal DNA in people around the world, that we have something like, I think it's 60% of the Neanderthal genome is alive and pushing around in various humans around the world right now. And so we already have most of the Neanderthal genome in our own species. All we would have to do is maybe we could do this just by finding people that have different parts of the Neanderthal genome and breeding them together in a very slow way without having to, to do any cloning.
I think right there highlights a lot of the ethical issues that we're dealing with. The genome editing technology that you've kind of been talking about here, and you mentioned this, is known as CRISPR. And it's been in the news a lot because sometimes scientists have claimed they've already altered human embryos using CRISPR. And scientists have started thinking about some self-governing standards for the use of this technology because the research seems to be moving more quickly than government regulation, and obviously with so many ethical considerations, there's some need there. Is anything of that sort happening within the de-extinction research community? Are these ethical issues being addressed in any formal way?
The community is actually small, people who think about this, and it comprises conservation biologists and ethicists, bioethicists. It's a really kind of an internet community that is mostly fostered by with the help of an organization called Revive and Restore, which is out of just north of San Francisco. It's Ryan Phelan and Stuart Brand. And they have created this incredible community of people who come together and mainly don't agree with each other, which is really nice. You know, we have these very fascinating debates about the ethics of different things. You have to understand that a lot of this is in the very, very early stages. There's no one... probably the furthest along group is the Spanish and French group that is trying to bring back a type of ibex that recently went extinct called a bucardo, and we can talk about that. But there are a couple of different groups around the world that are thinking about some of the technical or ethical or ecological challenges of different species that are candidates for de-extinction. But none of these efforts are very far. Very
but isn't
far
that,
along
but isn't that the ideal time to be thinking about these ethical things and perhaps putting some rules in place?
Well, yes to thinking about these things. I think it would be difficult to put rules in place because, like I've said, there are different challenges with any of the species that we're thinking about bringing back. And also, while we're in this stage where it really isn't possible to do this, it's very hard to do this work because... no one wants to pay for it either. I think that there's some incredible potential for conservation in learning how to use this technology and learning how to use it safely and ethically and in a way that we can do the best assessments of any potential risk involved with any parts of this process, including what I think one of the most important parts of the process that people seem to gloss over is what do you do with it once you've succeeded? I mean, how do you go about doing a risk assessment that says I can take this animal and actually release it into the wild somewhere? How do I do the risk assessment that says what the effects of that are going to be on that habitat, on the other species that are already there? There was a special issue of a journal that came out. It was led by Philip Seddon out of New Zealand, who also led a group of scientists putting together a recommendation for the IUCN about de-extinction. So people are thinking hard about what the risks are, what the rules should be, and how they should apply to different species or different approaches to de-extinction or different locations where you might want to think about doing this or different steps in the de-extinction process. And this group, this listserv that Ryan and Stuart have put together has been fundamental in that. I mean, these people are really coming together and a paper gets published. We have a debate about how right they are about some things, how wrong they are about other things, what we should do as a community, what recommendations we should make. take to this working group that's been put together with the IUCN. And in fact, that you're right, that this is now this is the time to think about this. Well, we can't do it, right? We can't do it.
Your initial interest in ancient DNA was to study evolution of populations in the past. How much of your time now is spent on this de-extinction idea versus those more basic questions that originally interested you?
It's an interesting question. I don't know. I'd say maybe I'm doing a lot of modern present day animal genomics as well. So I'm an evolutionary biologist at heart, and I'm very interested in trying to understand how evolution has shaped the diversity and of organisms that live around us and how they interact with each other. And I guess de-extinction kind of falls into that, because one of the big open questions is about how these organisms would interact with other organisms once they were brought back. And the learning about the past and about how organisms interacted with each other and how communities changed after extinction events or after massive climate change events can provide some insight into what might happen if we were to reintroduce a resurrected species into a habitat today.
Well, let's talk about that climate change part of it, because, of course, that's a major concern on a lot of people's minds right now, that we are in a period of rapid climatic change as a result of human activities. But the planet has been through other periods of climatic change, and you've actually looked in some cases at how that past climate change, particularly the transition between ice age and non-ice age, has affected animal populations. Based on what you've learned, does that give you cause for greater concern, or does that make you perhaps feel a little bit less concerned about what's going on right now?
It's definitely greater concern. What we see, so we work in the Arctic because bones from these large mammals survive better where it's very cold. The process of DNA decay, breaking down those long fragments into the tiny little broken up pieces of fragments, is slower where it's cold. These bones get defleshed by predators and then buried in the frozen dirt. And then it's like sticking them in a freezer for tens of thousands of years, and we can pull them out and the DNA looks pretty good. Over the course of the last couple million years, the Pleistocene ice ages, the Earth has been through a series of cold ice ages followed by warm interglacial periods. We're in an interglacial period right now, and the rapid warming event that got us into this interglacial period that we're in right now happened somewhere between 10 and 15,000 years ago. The peak of the last ice age was about 20 to 25,000 years ago in North America. So that was the coldest part of the last ice age. So most of the species that I've been studying up until now are cold adapted. So they did really well when it was really cold. And this includes mammoths and bison and horses and bears and all these. We had some fantastic animals that lived in North America during the cold periods. And
an enormous beaver apparently was one of them.
The giant beaver was a warm adapted species. So we had a different community of animals that thrived in the North American Arctic when it was interglacial times. We had camels, lots of camels, and giant sloths, and this crazy giant beaver, which is a pretty amusing extinct animal, a 5 foot tall.
I don't know if I find that amusing or not. Perhaps a little threatening.
Yeah, we've seen logs. People have found logs that have teeth marks from these massive beavers.
I mean, given what a small modern beaver can do, I'm not sure I want to see what a 5 foot tall beaver can do.
I imagine it was crazy. There was also a bear called Arctidus, a short-faced bear that, if it stood up on its hind legs, would be between 12 and 15 feet tall. I'm not sure we would have wanted to see him either, right? We probably did make those guys go extinct. They survived until around 8,000 years ago when we know there were people hunting them, but I don't know that anyone would have wanted a short-faced bear. Why are they called short-faced bears? Like, you would think that the most awesome thing about them would be their size, not the length of their nose, right?
I mean, but just thinking about these two different communities of animals that you're talking about, that's a huge shift in what's alive and what's extinct between glacial and interglacial.
But they weren't extinct each time, right? So this is what's important. What happened when it got cold is these warm adapted species would become isolated in refugial places that provided the habitat that they needed to survive. And the cold adapted species would dominate. Then it would get warm again. And the cold adapted species would survive in pockets of refugial habitat that they liked to live in. And then it would get warm again. And as you can see, these communities would shift back and forth. And the only time we saw massive extinction was this most recent shift. And what we're seeing happened during this most recent shift is that the connectivity between these refugial habitats was lost. And this probably had something to do with the arrival of humans. So you would have these refugial habitats where these cold-adapted animals would be, and they and people would probably say, oh, there's that big forest stand over there if you want to hunt bison or mammoths. That's where they're hanging out, because that's that refugial hotspot for them to be. And what we see from the genetic record is that because they were these little refugial hotspots were not connected to each other, individuals couldn't move back and forth. So you wouldn't, these populations would become increasingly inbred and increasingly small and increasingly less fit. And they were also really nice places for people to go and hunt. And so they were increasingly overhunted.
I mean, you're talking about a situation that's happening tens of thousands of years ago, but we could easily confuse what you're saying for what's going on right now,
and
right? We have fractured habitat even more. There are more people and less habitat for animals.
Yes. And this is why my answer to your question is more nervous, because if this is what is needed for animals to survive, connectivity between refugial locations where these animals can live, we are destroying all of that connectivity. And E.O. Wilson recently made this argument in his most recent book, where he said we need to save 10, you know, this, he said half and half, half for them, half for us. I don't think we're ever going to get to that. But he pointed out that what we really need are these bridges, these connections between refugial land that we've preserved for these animals, because if we don't allow them the ability to move between them, we'll have increasingly isolated, increasingly inbred, and increasingly unfit populations, which is conditions that are asking for extinctions to happen.
Unless we genetically modify them.
Unless we modify them, or unless we create these corridors, connectivity corridors between these particular habitats. And genetically modifying them isn't going to save them if they can't breed, if they can't do this. Genetically modifying them might mean that there's no more habitat that these things can live in because it's just not cold enough anywhere for them to live. Or we don't have the pH of the water systems that these things need to survive. So can we modify their genomes that they can survive in water that has lower pH? This might be important for fisheries management and for saving different fish species as ocean acidification takes place. If we can create a way to help them along to adapt to the things that we're doing to this planet, then maybe we can give a couple of species anyway a fighting chance at surviving.
I mean, how realistic is the idea that we could do this? Because obviously evolution moves very slowly, but even at the rate of technological improvement and innovation that we have today, it could be, what, decades before we're able to actually...
Unless people realize that we need to invest in this technology, that it is scary, but it's also hopeful. And this is something that we need to learn how to make it work before it's too late. It is a potentially powerful new weapon in, what I said before, should be a growing arsenal, but isn't, because we're too scared. And what we're going to need to do is stop being scared of stuff that hasn't happened yet and be more scared about what we're doing right now. Be scared that by doing nothing, we're actually pushing these species to extinction, and there might be ways that we can save them. There might be, but they're scary, and we need to get over being scared.
That's Beth Shapiro. She is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at UC Santa Cruz, a specialist in ancient DNA, and author of the book How to Clone a Mammoth. You can find a presentation by Beth that she made while here in Woods Hole on our website, capeandislands.org. Beth, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. It was fun.
Just a quick note before we end. The world made climate change history last week. The agreement drafted in Paris last December has been ratified by enough countries, including the U.S., to put it into force next month. That makes it one of just a handful of agreements in the history of the U.N. to enter into force in under a year. That's just the beginning of the story, though. With President Obama's Clean Power Plan tied up in federal courts, and one presidential candidate vowing to renegotiate or exit the agreement. We have more on our website about whether or not that would be possible, and what this all means for state and federal climate action. You can find that at capeandislands.org. Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Heather Goldstone and Elsa Partan. Mindy Todd is the executive producer. Major support for Living Lab comes from the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw and the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation.